This is Packet Pusher's Priority Queue. That's right, the greatest ever podcast on data networking because real engineers get together to talk nerdy about networking. Located in the hot aisle, wedged in between the server and the storage rack, one row over from those cupboards where all that stuff is that, well, nobody's never quite sure why I'm keeping the RS-232 cables in those old hard drives. But one day, you will find us diving on the technology issues that matter from the 10-meeting diver board with absolutely no fear. Packet Pushers is a place where no one has to speak in terms that business people understand. Nerdy is the normal, deep dive is the baseline, and you can smell the fumes of the virtual whiteboard markers in your ears. Today, we're going to be talking about network services headers. Somewhere around about show 228, we had a couple of people from Cisco, Dave Ward, on the show to talk about the value of network services headers, which is an extension of a technology Cisco's been driving for the last 5 or 6 years called security group tags to some extent. And this is now getting larger, bigger, and has now got a major push into the ITF. And the outcome of that is I didn't get the magic. I didn't feel empowered by this to think that network services headers was, you know, inverted commas, good thing. So I got back in contact with Dave Ward and said it didn't take. And he said, I need to send in a team to perform bigger exorcisms. So today I'm joined by some new people from Cisco. But first of all, Mr. Banks, how are you today, sir?
Hey, doing pretty good. And thought it was novel that the two guys we're recording with aren't on the West Coast in the Silicon Valley, but they're actually out here in the East Coast, where all good technologists should be. I'd like to welcome one of our sponsors today, the Open Networking Summit, ONS. ONS is the pioneering and premier SDN and NFV conference designed to foster a productive dialogue around the opportunities, challenges, and key developments in the quickly evolving world of SDN and NFV. They bring together the networking ecosystem of end users, engineers, business leaders, and researchers to discuss the possibilities and shape the future of the networking industry. This year, ONS 2015 is held June 14th through 18th in Silicon Valley, California, and features an expanded program developed to provide networking professionals with pragmatic information on SDN today, as well as providing direction to further innovation taking place in the industry. Focus of this year's conference is on education, sharing of experiences and best practices, thought leadership, and vision for the future. Participants will not only benefit from watching and listening to presentations and panel discussions, but also will contribute to discussions to advance the SDN industry. ONS 2015 program features 3 keynotes, 3 panels, 3 plenaries, and 9 tracks, and covers use cases and deployment experiences across service providers, enterprises, cloud, and data centers. Keeping with the open networking theme, ONS 2015 will emphasize all leading open networking projects, Open Daylight, OPNFV, and Open Networking Operating System, ONOS, via talks, developer tracks, and tutorials for each. Additionally, speakers from leading incumbent and startup vendors will share their innovations and customer experiences. To view detailed conference program, distinguished speakers, and to register, visit www.opennetsummit.org. Use discount code PACKETPUSHERS to get a 15% discount on registration. One more time, that's www.opennetsummit.org. Use discount code PACKETPUSHERS to get a 15% discount on registration.
Yeah, I'm going to be a bit twitchy today because this show is between me and beer o'clock. Mm. So this could be
you could be more curmudgeonly than normal, you're saying.
Yeah, and now I've got an excuse. So joining us today is Jim Guichard. How are you, Jim? And tell people a little bit about yourself.
I'm doing great. Thank you, Greg and Ethan, for having us on the show today. Jim Guichard, I work in the CTO office at Cisco, and my background is routing and all things MPLS, and over the last few years working on these network service headers. So hopefully today I'm one of the magicians that can tell you what this is all about and clear up some of the confusion.
Very good. And also with us today is Paul Quinn. Paul, welcome to the show and tell people a bit about yourself.
Thank you for having both of us. My name is Paul Quinn. I am an East Coast-based technologist, recently transplanted to the East Coast, and my expertise is actually service chaining. I've spent quite a bit of time on service chaining after migrating to it from security and primarily focused on data center and cloud systems at Cisco.
Ooh, cloud systems. What does that mean?
How we put things together. It's how we put things together. It's a whole stack. It's the new term. Is that the new term? The complete stack.
The complete stack? I'm not sure. I'm still coming to terms with the cloud because every time I look around, it looks like a different shaped cloud. Is it cumulo, nimbus, you know, whatever. And it's like, And hybrid cloud, I still can't quite come at that, but there you go. So today we want to talk a little bit about network services headers. So let's quickly kick off with a bit of a review. If you haven't listened to show 228, which is long and detailed, we probably should quickly throw over and give us a summary of what network services headers is meant to do.
Sure. So network service headers is, let's back up for a second. A while ago, I guess it's about 2.5 years now, the IETF decided to form a working group around what's dubbed at the IETF service function chaining. And the idea is that increasingly we need to change how network services, firewalls, load balancers, DPI and the like, are added to networks. And as part of that, one of the outcomes of that working group is what has been dubbed the so-called SFC, service function chaining NCAP. And this NCAP is used to control the service chain. And NSH, network service header, is the now recently adopted draft that'll form the basis for that SFC NCAP. And grossly speaking, the SFC NCAP is chartered to provide two things. Service path or service chain, and we can talk a little bit about the nuances between a path and a chain. Path information for stitching together the services, and equally, if not more importantly, the ability to exchange data plane metadata to the nodes in the service chain. So that's what network service headers is. It's a protocol, a data plane protocol that we add to packets or frames to create or to realize a service chain and to exchange metadata down that service chain.
And just real quick, for people that maybe aren't even getting this whole service chain concept, if you have to run traffic through something, you know, I think you might have mentioned this a little bit earlier, but a firewall, load balancer, whatever it is, normally what you would do is you're going to build that chain statically. You're going to plummet to the network, and using routing, you're going to pump traffic through these devices. But in a data center that's highly virtualized, or in a data center that is using a lot of segmentation because it's of multi-tenancy, you need to be able to route traffic through those devices in a much more flexible way, where having to stick a physical device in line is really, you know, hamstringing you. Okay, so service chaining is that. How am I going to route this traffic through these devices and not necessarily rely on traditional routing to achieve that goal? And so that's really the whole context of our conversation here with service chaining and now NSH.
One thing, that started off this work was really, if you look at how service chaining is done today, it uses really rudimentary techniques. So, you know, things like VLAN stitching or policy-based routing and, more recently using import-export tricks in routing between the VRFs and so forth. And, you know, what we find is that leads to a very static model for building these services that have, you know, a number of service elements. We call those service functions in the IETF. So what we wanted to do was kind of build a protocol that allows us to be much more dynamic in how we can build those services and be able to scale them both vertically and horizontally without having to make a bunch of network changes that we would have to do today if we rely on VLAN stitching or policy-based routing. So that's kind of some of the background there.
And I'm going to imagine that, I read the whole draft on the current draft on NSH. You're wanting this to be backwards compatible with the infrastructures that people already have in place.
To a certain extent, yes. The fabric, the core, absolutely. By no means, and we'll delve into this, but by no means does NSH suggest or require a change of the transport network. We do, in the NSH world, require NSH-aware nodes, and we'll talk about the terminology in a little bit, but essentially that front end the services. It'll take a little while for services to adopt NSH. And in the meanwhile, we support a mechanism where these so-called non-NSH-aware services can function. And we've had deployments and testing going on, and so we can support that type of environment.
I think you're making an important point here. I don't know if you were making it or not, but you're talking about services being NSH aware, right? Those higher level functions that are aware that they are a part of a service chain and are able to read that header and do something with it. But you're not talking about the transport needing to be aware of NSH. In other words, we don't need our Ethernet switch to have an ASIC that can read NSH in order to benefit from this.
You don't necessarily. So let's take a step back and talk about definitions a little. And I know we're getting super nerdy here, but I think it'll help put it in context. There's an associated or a companion draft to NSH. There's a service function chaining architecture draft. that is going through the motions at IETF, it defines what we would call a service function forwarder. And the service function forwarder is what connects the service function, that upper layer service, to the network. That service function forwarder is logical. It might be an Ethernet switch. It might be a top of rack. Might be a vSwitch. It might be part of the service function.
So when we talk about a network service, you're talking about a VM with something running in there like firewall, WAN compression, load balancer, traffic groomer, deep inspection, IDS, IPS, something like that.
That's correct. So right. Any of those.
Yeah, and I think... Sorry, Paul. So I think the other thing that we tried to do when we built the architecture was there's a lot of talk about, you know, virtualized service functions. But what we want to do is make sure that we have an architecture that supports both physical and virtual. So when you think about NSH, what we really are talking
so
about
what,
is
well,
that
let's just stop there. Why would you bother? Why would you even bother with physical things?
We hear one of the things we hear a lot from customers, and we can discuss whether you guys are hearing the same thing. We call them customers, you probably call them peers, is that I have physical appliances. In many cases, I need them for performance reasons or for compliance reasons. Yeah. And I need to have a model that encompasses it because when I move to this new world and I'm going to, you know, again, I'm going to go buzzword and I apologize, but I'm going to orchestrate it. I'm going to, you know, control it. I need a common model because once I start having onesie twosies that don't do what it needs, I lose some of that economy of scale.
Well, but the flip side of this is how much baggage do we want to carry along behind us? The future of networking is not defined by physical. Sorry, there are parts of networking which are definitely physical. Ethernet interfaces, 100 gig, 40 gig, silicon forwarding, you know, those types of, you know, how many TCAMs can I have? But when it comes to service chaining, the concept of having physical devices in a service chain, I've not had anybody in the last 3 years ask me about physical service chain devices.
And all we're saying is, if you have one, it
you're
can
an idiot.
Be supported in NSH. No, no, I'm not saying that.
Sorry, I said that. Yeah. I just don't...
All we're saying is the model is applicable, and because, as you point out, it could be the driver in the software, it could be the NIC, and so on. Architecturally, you can support this NSH and we will support it in the Cisco appliances. You know, again, I'm not making platform commitments, but in general, we will support it if as a customer needs it.
I see the IETF do this over and over and over. They keep trying to, you know, hold on to the legacy. Let's keep everything backwardly compatible. I mean, Ethernet is guilty of this. Everything's got to be like 100 meters in cabling when it makes perfectly good common sense to have a 20 meter, you know, copper cable because that is the distance that the signal can travel. Right? But no, we had to wait 4 more years for them to work out how to make it run 100 meters, which was silly. I just think that sometimes we have to draw a line and say, right, some things are stupid. You should stop being stupid.
I guess the way to look at it in this context is there's nothing we did with NSH to accommodate. What we're saying is the model is applicable, and that's really it. Mm-hmm. We didn't bend or change things for it. Quite the opposite, actually. We're very virtual friendly. In environments where you have physical, we fully expect to be able to support it. And I think that's just the easiest way to say it.
I mean, I can see carriers would want us, you know, their legacy physical stuff to be reused for another 20 years.
Or compliance. Some compliance reason to require a firewall in a certain form. Or
compliance is always stupid and can always be worked around, but people just try a bit harder. I've done it plenty often enough in compliance stuff to say, if you read it like this, you can do whatever you like. And they go, oh, yeah, never thought about it like that.
You must be fun at tax time.
I have someone else do that.
Yeah. So regardless of your form factor, we have this concept of a service function forwarder. And that forwarder has to be NSH aware. Now, that forwarder, as I said, is a logical component. Physical, virtual, top of rack, Ethernet switch, vSwitch, driver in a device. That's all fine. The network fabric, the forwarding routers, the P routers, the fabric switches and all that do not need to be NSH aware, of course.
And that's because the service function forwarder reads the header or can impose a header, if I remember right, and then knows from that header to get from where I am to the next link in the chain, I need to encapsulate this packet this way with something, VXLAN, whatever it might be, and then send it. And so before it leaves the service function forwarder, it gets encapsulated and shipped across the fabric. Tell me if I'm right or wrong there.
You're absolutely right. So the forwarder uses the NSH, and we should talk about the information NSH in a second here, but it uses the information NSH as an identifier only. And that identifier, in the strictest definition of identifier, is used to select the appropriate network overlay to forward the packet to the next service in. Yeah. And that decoupling is what creates this abstract chain, if you will, as opposed to, as we started the show, saying, well, I have a bunch of VLANs, I got to add more VLANs, I got to do PBR. We have a layer of indirection between the transport and the service chain.
So you're using the overlay functionality just to deliver the packet wherever it needs to go, that layer of indirection. It gets to its destination, and then that recipient also needs to be NSH aware at that point?
That's correct. The overlay is constructed service function forwarder to service function forwarder. Mm-hmm. And the service function forwarders, as I said, need to be aware. They look at the NSH and they say, oh, this packet's destined to firewall 62. Oh, this packet is destined to load balancer 28 or whatever the case may be. At the end of the chain, the last forwarder strips off the NSH and emits an unmodified by the service chaining infrastructure packet. Now, that doesn't mean the services themselves couldn't have changed the packet, but the actual chaining doesn't, as opposed to today where you might do things like source NAT and so on to control the chain. We don't touch any of that. Packet comes out and gets delivered as expected.
Okay, so maybe now we can talk about what is actually in that header. If we have a kind of an idea of how it gets from device to device in the chain and then what happens to it at the end of the chain, okay, what all is in the header? Because this is one of the things that threw me when I was reading the draft. It's not just a list of IP destinations with an overlay methodology to get to those destinations. It's also a bunch of fields that are available for metadata and things that you can might be interesting to devices in the service chain could be found in that metadata. You guys want to expand on all of that?
That's exactly right. So a couple of points to make. I think one of the confusions was that, you know, the overlay that we use could be, and we did this very deliberately, we decided we didn't want to go and touch all of those different transport overlays to be able to do service chaining. What we wanted was an encapsulation that could be carried in any of those overlays. So
you mean you're saying you didn't want to look at VXLAN and go, okay, how can we modify fields that are available to us in VXLAN to achieve service chaining and then, you know, whatever other protocols? You wanted to do something else that was transport agnostic.
In my case, obviously, I didn't want to go and try and figure out how to make service chaining work in, you know, MPLS, for example, or VXLAN or GRE or any of the other host of different transports. So what we did was we bumped it up a bit and created this header that we use that can be carried in any of those transports. So in the header itself, basically what we did was we broke it down into really three component parts. So the first part was a base header that kind of has a bunch of information on the packet itself, the original payload, as well as, you know, the format of whatever metadata might be carried in there and some other things as well. The second piece was the service path header, which gives us a path identification as well as an index, and I'll talk about that in a second. And then the third part is the metadata itself. So we've broken that into a couple of formats, which we can talk in more detail, but essentially that metadata comes after the path identification. So the way that the forwarding works is that we use that path header, which has got the path ID and the index to do the forwarding. So the idea is you send the traffic through the overlay to a service function forwarder, as Paul described, and then that service function forwarder looks at that path header, which has got the path ID and the index, and it does a lookup on that, and that tells it which particular service needs to be applied at this particular point in the service chain. And then what happens is that index gets decremented at each service hop until eventually you get to the end of the service chain and the NSH encapsulation is removed and the packet is forwarded natively.
Okay. And in there was also a TTL field, as I recall.
Yeah, there's not a TTL field as such. There's what we call a service index, which what that does is it allows us to identify where we are in the path. But you can also, you know, use that as a kind of a TTL mechanism where, you know, we decrement that down and we know what that value should be at each point in the service chain. And therefore, you know, if that keeps on going, we know we have an issue there.
If it shows up at a service function forward or with a value of zero, we can assume that maybe a loop happened or something.
Exactly, yeah. But its primary purpose is to tell us where we are in the service chain at any given point.
One thing that popped in my head about this is, okay, we were adding a header to a packet, and then we're doing an end cap of this whole thing. So there's yet more length to this packet in an environment that may already have other overlays and so on that are going on. Has anybody expressed a concern about fragmentation? I mean, it's the fragmentation paragraph is notably unpopulated in the draft right now.
So fragmentation, of course, comes up in any context when you talk about overlays, in all overlay contexts, so Lisp, MPLS segment routing, and so on. In this case, in general, the obvious answer is we solve it with jumbo frames in the data center, and that's been very well received, and we have a lot of examples of using it as such and haven't had problems. Then, of course, you start looking at the traditional PM2D and all the other fragmentation handling. The easiest answer, and I don't want to sound glib, is of course jumbo frames.
The same answer for everything else. Yeah,
of course. But, yeah, there's no magic here, right?
Right.
we're doing the same dance. We just carry different information.
So that means, but however, in WAN networks or carrier networks, they still got a heinous crime against any frames bigger than 1513 bytes.
Right, and then we rely on the pushback to the edge that does the in-cap to break it up.
Yeah.
The M2D and such, right.
Because service chaining is much a WAN thing as it is a data center thing, right? In the data center, we could use this, you know, network services in DMZs or micro-segmentation to channel traffic from one secure segment to one secure segment via firewalls or inspection engines as is needed, right?
Right. We see, actually, you raise a good question, and maybe let me answer it by just kind of saying we see several big quote-unquote use cases. I know it's a higher-level use case. We see a lot of applicability in the branch office in the increasingly complex branch environment, interestingly enough. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of course, applicability in the data center. That goes without saying, right? Most data centers have a ton of these things running around. A shocking amount, at least to me, because I don't sit in that world, a lot of mobility use cases. And I guess that's kind of cousins, if you will, to the data center. But it's very, very compelling in that space. And then lastly, as you alluded to, kind of over the WAN, because I'm linking a branch or a remote site to a data center, and I want to do some chaining in the branch and some chaining in the data center, like a contiguous chain. And in that case, absolutely, we carry
but
it over.
There's also the WAN. Carriers want to be able to offer services to customers. So they want to be able to say, well, Mr. Customer, why don't we run a WAN accelerator for you? You just send your traffic to us. Oh, I see your WAN. So we run it through a WAN accelerator transparently. Click a button, services enabled. You know, or home environments. You want to have a firewall for your home environment? Click a button here and we implement a virus and malware scanner on your service.
That to me is an extension of, absolutely. And that's an extension of kind of branch to data center. It's managed services, and those services reside in quote unquote, and I'm going to use your favorite word, the cloud. So, but yes, absolutely, and we see all those. And if you look at, you know, some of the work going on in ITF, representation from those constituent groups are well represented.
Well, why not Lisp for this? Why not Lisp to do this service chaining function?
So let me go on record here. I am a huge Lisp fan. I have no problem saying that.
So am I, by the way. I mean, I think Lisp was... The problem with Lisp, of course, was that the first generation was focused on doing it in the hardware, and that was a huge mistake because it instantly stopped anybody being interested.
Oh, that's an interesting perspective. Okay. I'll let you guys beat up on the Lisp guys with that. You guys can get Daryl or someone. But we are doing it with Lisp. And what I mean by that is, and expect to see some drafts and some things come out. I don't think I'm foreshadowing too much here. What we view is Lisp is the transport. So very much as we talk about VXLAN, and before I use Lisp as my example of an overlay, Lisp is our transport. And the way we couple the two, and I'll tell you why we do this in a moment, is we use the path ID index as, if you will, the key to the mappings. And the reason we want to do this is because the path ID index combination, I'll just call it path ID going forward, represents the collection of traffic that must be forwarded into a service chain. It can represent a group of flows, many five tuples and so on, It gives us a tremendous efficiency from a flow lookup perspective. So now we say, look, all of Ethan's traffic needs to go in service chain one, and all of Paul's traffic needs to go in service chain two. And when I need to do my overlay lookups, I use that path ID, and I can get, in the list case, the appropriate next hops. I don't have to try to do a multi-5-tuple lookup at each hop to derive my correct locators. So we do that.
At the price of complexity, though.
Is a 32-bit lookup a complex operation?
Well, that's my point entirely. A 5-tuple lookup's no more complex than a 32-bit operation
exactly,
these days.
Yeah. But you still got a lookup.
But 1,000 of them is.
By the time you guys finish the ITF standard, we'll have hardware that does it.
No, no. Let me rephrase. Let's look at it this way. Let's take a subscriber coming in. I'm picking an example I know least about, but I think it's a telling example. You know you're brave when
We won't judge you on the example, but we'll go with it anyway.
No, you know when you're – let's take a mobility example.
Yeah.
I can break mobile users, grossly speaking, into buckets, right? I'm not interested in traffic per mobile user. I'm interested in traffic per type of mobile user. So I'll say, for example, iPhone versus Android. What I can do now is very simply identify the path for Android users by a single lookup only at the SFFs, not per hop. I don't have to try to derive through IP addressing schemes or some form of CIDR allocation or something like that who Android users are. So I identify a path because that's what I'm interested in. And at each SFF, I do that simple lookup. What it also allows me to do is continue that consistent pathing in the face of packet transformations. So should NAT occur, I don't have to be aware at the forwarding infrastructure to go change my classification rules. I survive packet transformations and I identify the path simply from a forwarding perspective and B, from a visibility, troubleshooting, and so on perspective. I look at a packet, I go, oh, your service chain one packets and you're between service one and two, your service chain 62 packets and you're between 28 and 29.
So there are other ways to uniquely identify a packet other than, you know, a new tag. I mean, for example, DSCP can identify a traffic class, if you will, and you make decisions based on that, not on whatever transformations might have occurred.
In principle, there are other ways to do it, but in practice, not so much, right? DSCP has semantics and meaning to the network that can't just be taken because we want to. More importantly, DSCP and their ilk aren't necessarily providing the semantics we want from a service chaining perspective. In general, I don't do overlay lookups on DSCP values, and I don't provide visibility on it and so on from a service perspective, right? Here, I'm able to use this path to construct a relatively complex or a very complex service topology without requiring complex forwarding rules. And that's very, very powerful. So one thing I would say in the initial stage is certainly think of services as a relatively simple linear, you know, service one, service two, service three. But don't be constrained by that. We fully envision more complex service topologies that have cycles and other graph-like characteristics. And being able to construct those without overloading is not easy to do otherwise.
So, okay, that's all. That's fair enough, and I kind of get it because of the complexity of what you're trying to accomplish. You need more nuance in the header that tells us what's going on. Okay, well, what about latency? I mean, now we're talking about having a lookup. It is, at least at the SFF level, on a per-packet basis because every packet gets a NSH I guess NSH header is redundant, isn't it? It gets an NSH and it gets an overlay NCAP process, which adds, again, two things that have to happen before that packet is forwarded into the infrastructure. Is latency a concern here?
In our work thus far, latency has not been a concern. The lookups are relatively straightforward. In hardware, for example, the lookup is done at quote-unquote wire rate. In other words, we do that at ASIC rate, at line rate in the hardware. And in software, the lookup is relatively simple. We pipeline it and it looks, you know, like a standard lookup and it's not overly expensive. As you guys alluded to, I think, earlier, it's akin to a label lookup from a complexity perspective.
Well, wait a minute. What ASIC are you talking about? This is brand new. It's still in draft in the IETF.
As I alluded to in one of the blog posts, we will have a Cisco hardware roadmap for this. I don't think there's any secret there. We also have, or other vendors have demonstrated support at Mobile World Congress, for example. Intel showed 40 and 100 gig ASIC support in the NICs for this. So there's hardware coming. Some is available soon. I certainly can't speak to Intel roadmaps, but you know, we'll have a hardware suite as well that supports it. And if you look at the draft, again, without disclosing anything, if you look at the co-authors on the draft, many hardware, quote-unquote hardware vendors are represented there.
Yeah, Alcaloo, Brocade, Citrix, Ericsson, Intel, Marvell, Rackspace, Microsoft, Red Hat, all the usual criminals. Some of the names are just names. Some of the people actually do some. Some of the people on that list are names that I see on an awful lot of RFCs, and I know there's no way they can be involved in all of them. So there's only a few people here doing the real work, but there's a lot of names on the RFC.
Yeah, Broadcom, I think, is on there as well. So a lot of work.
Well, 26 last count.
Yeah. Can I get my name on it too?
Are you going to implement it?
No, my job's to complain about it.
Then no. Then you can just join everyone else. Actually, we've had, I should say, you know, I'll confess, I'm a relative newbie to the IETF in general, but overwhelmingly, it's been well supported in terms of, you know, of course, there's the normal discussions, should it do this, should it do that, but overall, support for this model of forwarding and chaining has been very well accepted.
Okay, so we've got the thing. So one of the things that disturbs me about this is that one of the problems I have with MPLS is that while it made sense in 1998 when I first started looking at tag switching, because what we needed was a way to do NAT without doing NAT, and we ended up NATing IP into MPLS tags, right? Because we didn't have enough TCAM space in our physical hardware at the time. But so then we had to build an LDP protocol to distribute label information. And then we built BGP to distribute the IP reachability information on the end of the MPLS tags. So now I've introduced MPLS tags to a protocol. I've got a label distribution protocol to distribute. And then I've got BGP. And now I've got a metric ton of complexity that has to be managed and handled and solved. And I mean, it's taken networking vendors at least 15 years to get BGP stable and reliable to the point in 2015 where you actually really feel that BGP is, you know, usable and predictable. With network services, how is the control plane going to be built? If you're going to say, I'm now going to have a network services header for the services mapping function, then underneath that there's going to be some Lisp and some VXLAN and some, you know, the turtles all the way down to where you actually get to an Ethernet frame. Where's the control plane functionality and how complex does that look?
So from the control plane side of things, I mean, we right now from the standardization perspective, we kind of deliberately made a decision to avoid that, at least initially, because we wanted to get the data plane pieces worked out and, you know, the broad support that we're already enjoying now within the IETF. So I think it's fair to say that, you know, the control plane is kind of like the next phase, although there's a lot of implementation going on, you know, both within, you know, different companies, but also in the open source environment. So, you know, Paul and I have been involved in the Open Daylight effort, and we have a fully functioning control plane implementation in Open Daylight for service function chaining, and we can, you know, set up all of the NSH information that we need using that platform.
Enlighten us a little bit more on that. Is that a like an accepted project that's a part of ODL and the standard distro, or is this that just something that you've worked on the side that plugs into ODL?
No, it's a full project within Open Daylight. It's got its own distribution because we distribute the SFC component as well as some Python code and a GUI as well that you can use to actually access the controller through the RESTConf APIs. But that's all public code. And in fact, there's quite a number of companies that have been involved in that implementation. So I forget all of them, but it's not just a Cisco implementation on Open Daylight. It's very much a joint effort between us and a number of other companies.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, one thing we wish to mention is it's very much a core project in ODL. If you pull the ODL repo, you'll get the service chaining infrastructure. It was an official project in Helium. There's a much richer set in Lithium and so on.
Okay, so the control plane, people could choose to have ODL or, you know, each vendor might have its own choice of, you know, using this tagging mechanism as a standard. And hypothetically, there might even be some interoperability between them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we should address your comment about complexity and so on. Because the service chaining infrastructure, the NSH information, is separate from the overlay, I would actually argue there's some simplification. And what I mean by that is, if you look at what we did in ODL, the only thing the SFF has to know is, for a given path ID, what the next SFF locator is. So if you guys are Lisp fans, which sounds like you are, the concept of locator and identifier. This NSH takes that to what we would call a services plane. So you can say, look, all the SFF does is does a lookup and ask for a locator. And that locator could be delivered to it via ODL, via Lisp, via BGP, via whatever mechanism you want. But because we've decoupled it, in many ways, I would actually argue that we've simplified, because you're not sitting there trying to plumb things together. It's that indirection that makes it powerful.
Well, you're right. So abstraction. So if you look at the theoretical five layers of the OSI model, let's pretend that 6 and 7 don't actually exist, because they don't really. But, you know, the TCP, the IP, the Ethernet, and then the physical make, you know, there's abstraction between them. But there's also a point to be made that there's also a price of complexity. You know, there was a time 20 years ago when we just used Ethernet and we actually had signaling and routing protocols inside the Ethernet. Mm-hmm. And we needed it to scale up. And that's why IP came valuable, and then TCP allowed you to have multiple services over a single IP. So, but there was a price to be paid for TCP IP and a five-layer model, in that every abstraction increased the complexity of the overall implementation. We had to have routing, and that meant we had to have routing. So to have routing, we had to have routing protocols. And because you wanted to, you know, each TCP state had to be sustained separately in the end host, you know, those sorts of things. This network services thing, I still can't get away from the fact that I can just use flows to program point-to-point between points in the service chain. I don't need network services headed to achieve this.
Oh, absolutely. You don't need it. I am not. We certainly wouldn't advocate it. I would posit, and I'll speak for myself here, I would posit that you'll be able to build much more complicated, and complicated either because of scale and the number of flows, or complicated because of the topology, service chains, than you could otherwise with it. And I mean, if you look at some of the work done by the operators who are testing this, there was a presentation done by NTT, for example, at the last IETF, they are reaching that conclusion as well. Let's go back to your abstraction, though. I mean, it's the old joke, right? Or the old quote, all problems of computer science can be solved by another level of indirection. And and there's no doubt. What I think architecturally we try to do here, we strive to do here, is create, for lack of a better term, a services plane. And by doing that, we needed a locator ID paradigm or model for that plane, and this provides it. And it, I mean, the example is this. Let's take your comment about flows. If you take an open flow switch and you want to program relatively complex service chains, including NAT, including perhaps other packet modifications, you're going to end up writing pretty heavy, pretty complicated, pretty error-prone rules per switch, and you're going to have your controller or whatever you're using to program the flows be aware of those packet transformations. So now if the services guys say, hey, we're adding NAT, they have to come and tell you, hey, Mr. Control guy, you got to write flows that take into account NAT. But not only that, I have to tell you which flows are going to which NAT pool, because you have to carry that through. So absolutely you could do it, just like you could do it with a bunch of VLANs. What we would say in the NSH world is the cost of doing that, both from a risk, from a complexity, is very high. And increasingly, as we started the show, as we move to much more dynamic environments, it becomes harder and harder to do so.
Yeah, you're making a case here that in the most complex of service chaining circumstances, the standard ways that we could move flows around the network just aren't going to be adequate, or are going to be so complex as to break frequently. It'd be too difficult to maintain. So you bake all that functionality into NSH and abstract it all away. You know, at the end of the day, you're forwarding based on a service identifier.
You do a lookup on a service identifier, and it solves. It's vastly simplifies. And I would argue that, you know, as we move to more and more complicated service chains, and we're seeing that. I mean, that's why I was shocked. I told you I was shocked by the mobility. Their service chaining requirements are so complicated in reality that, you know, a model that doesn't simplify it makes their requirements almost untenable. Not that they couldn't do it. It's just there's a lot of machinations to do so. And what we found is, and they've found, is this vastly simplified that. Now, the one thing we haven't talked about yet, we've been very focused, like good network guys, we've been very focused on forwarding and paths. And yeah. We all love that. The thing we haven't talked about is metadata. And really, that's what precipitated a lot of this work, is this need for metadata down the service chain.
Yeah, the stuff you guys are throwing in the metadata was throwing me in the draft as you guys were describing some of that. So I want to hear this story.
So metadata at a high level is the result of classification. And let's step back. If we look today how we apply policy on a service, so firewall. I like firewall. You know why I like firewall? Because everyone knows what it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we pick these esoteric ones. No one knows what we're talking about. Pick firewall.
Everybody's got, you know, firewalls are like arseholes. Everybody's got them.
That's the quote of the show, by the way. Put that on your Twitter tag, your Twitter feed. So firewall today, it applies policies one of two ways, grossly speaking. And please, I'm going to say this now. For the folks listening, the firewall guys, don't send me angry emails. I know they're very complicated devices. I'm just saying, grossly speaking, it either uses something like an interface or some other network thing, a VLAN, right? To say, look, you came in on VLAN red, you're bad. You're going out on VLAN blue, you're good. Some networky thing. Or it does reclassification each time. So it sees the packet, it looks at the IP tuples, it might go deeper, and so on. And what NSH says is, look, tying to network, we all pretty much agree, not a good way forward, particularly as networks become more and more dynamic. That idea that VLAN 1 is good and VLAN 2 is bad is not so great. And classification is expensive and not always accurate, particularly with crypto, particularly with other things, right? So what we can say here is, let's impose information in the packet at the start of the chain. And I'm going to get to some complicated ones in a minute, but let's say at the start of the chain. And at the start of the chain, we can tell the nodes what this traffic is. So for example, we could say, this is Paul's traffic. Or we could say, this is web server traffic, if you're familiar with the concept of endpoint groups and that kind of thing. And we carry that information in the NSH. When the packet hits the firewall doesn't have to, it certainly could, but it doesn't have to try to reclassify. It looks at the metadata and it says, hey, cool, this is Paul, he's a bad actor, let's deny his traffic. Or this is web traffic going to database traffic, let's permit it. So again, before you guys yell at me, of course it's another level of abstraction, but one that has seen tremendous take-up, acceptance as the way to author policy on the services.
You mentioned endpoint groups. That's an ACI APIC construct, grouping things and then building policy around those endpoint groups that you've built. Does it extend beyond Cisco ACI to the industry?
It does. I believe it does. There is an open source project in both OpenStack and OpenDaylight that offers group-based policy to OVS and to OpenDaylight, and as I said, through OpenStack, through the APIs. And if you ever want to talk to those folks, we could certainly facilitate that. I use that as an example.
Okay, but so taking that example then, mm-hmm. what you're really saying is we don't have to rely on the whatever the service device is to look at the packet that's been delivered to it and go, okay, I know what this is. It belongs here, and I'm going to do this with it. It can look at the network service header instead and say, this is tagged as thus and such in the metadata, and therefore I'm going to process it this way and not care about IPs or the standard kind of tuples that we think about when we send a packet to a device.
That's one example. And the reason is, in many cases, the tuples aren't sufficient anymore, right? I mean, this call over Skype is probably tunneling over some other protocol or some other port. Figuring out what it is a relatively expensive operation. But let's take it one step farther. This five-tuple game, let's say I can play it successfully, but I have multiple services. Now I'm doing the same heavy lifting per service to try to figure things out. Or, conversely, I'm putting it into different VLANs, which we all agree is a bad idea. So what I can do now with this metadata is I can share the results down the chain. So let me give you a real example. I'm a service provider and I'm taking traffic in from mobile devices and I want to know what it is so I can offer, header enrichment or video optimization or other services that I offer as a service provider. My first service in the chain might be DPI. And DPI might figure out that I have two applications, just to make it simple, application one and application two. And now I'm going to deliver that to a firewall for enforcement. Well, DPI can now inform a downstream service about that result, and the downstream service might never have been able to figure it out. We very much see those kind of use cases not being theoretical. We actually have, you know, people trying and testing those kind of use cases.
So I can see the use case, but it's a stupid use case.
Okay, tell me why.
So if you start putting metadata in, like, I've actually sent this packet through a firewall, so now it needs to go to an IDS, and then the IDS drops a tag and says it's been through the IDS. But the devices themselves capture this information. The metadata might be useful if you're actually trying to create a stateless solution, that is nothing without a central controller, or it's part of an autonomous process. So you build, you know, you strap some more onto BGP to distribute the information around what the state of the network services header is, right? Again, the header itself is of no value until there's something actually spreading information around the state. If you start carrying metadata in the tag, then you're saying my control plane is rubbish. Or worthless or valueless.
Oh, no.
But I'm always going, in a services driven environment, I'm always going to have a controller. I'm always going to have something polling my APIs to say this packet went through this, this path went through this. If it's not there, this protocol is not valuable. There's no point.
Guys, correct me if I'm wrong. The way I took the draft was that NSH was not dependent on, did not assume centralized control. Distributed control could work.
No, that's not my point. My point is, without centralized control and monitoring and billing, it's not valuable. A service chain is only valuable if you can bill it. So if you just randomly send data through a firewall and then put a metadata tag on saying, I went through a firewall, that's inherently useless data.
Oh, I'm
the
not
metadata
saying.
Is not valuable because it doesn't add anything to a process when it's already in a controller somewhere or an orchestration engine somewhere.
So I think there's a little, maybe I misexplained things. We are not, the metadata would not say I went through a firewall at all. Yeah. The metadata simply is, the easiest way to describe metadata in this context is the result of classification. And all I'm saying is that the previous service or a service in the chain can impose metadata that another service can consume. It doesn't state that it went through a firewall on IPS. Mm. It's rather information about the traffic, not about the service.
Yeah, but my point is, so now you're starting to do signaling in band. So you're saying, I'm going to use a network services header with flags to signal in band that something has happened or some transition or state has been achieved, right?
No, but, see, I think that's the distinction. It's not that something has happened. It's signals simply a result. It's not an action. And there's a difference in that. There's a subtle difference, right? I simply say, let's take the simple case. I say this is video versus not video. Let's just take that case. That's all I'm going to say. And yes, but the downstream node needs to have been told, if you see video, do this. If you see non-video, do that. But assume that the downstream node...
My point is that it still stands, right? You're still, what you're now saying is in-band, I'm signaling. You're using like... I've got an edge classification engine. It injects a tag into the network services header to say, I've classified this traffic as this, so that devices down the chain can now use that flag to set something. It's video, it's not video. It's QoST, it's not QoST. It's high priority, it's low priority. It could be, you know, a tenant idea. It could be whatever it is. Am I right so far?
So far, you're right. You impose information about the packet. It's annotation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So in DSCP, we just dumbly inject a tag and trust that everybody in the path will honor that tag. And it's failed miserably.
Yes.
Right? So the idea of putting metadata into a tag is pointless for the same reasons that DSCP is pointless, right? And in any service chain, there must be an orchestrator and an automator function. Mm-hmm. The service forwarding function configuration must be defined with sight of the end-to-end functionality. So the process of inserting a metadata tag seems to be like pointless. Having a tag to do this doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me still.
It's so funny you should say that. And I don't mean that dismissively. I'm just saying it's funny because the one thing the ITF originally agreed on is that metadata was the use case. Mm. So that's funny. Let's step back for a second.
My point is that when you talk to carrier people, or people at big companies, they're always looking at it from the point of view that you've got to carry all your information in your suitcase. And it's like walking around with an 80-kilo backpack with everything that you need to survive in the desert for 4 weeks. But the reality in a modern network is that you actually don't need that anymore because the orchestration engine will have predefined the state in the network.
No, what I'm saying is the information provided here is abstract to the 5-tuple. And if you want to do it out of band, quote-unquote out of band, you know, the orchestration engine, there's... it's much, much harder. So think of it this way. Let's back up for a second.
Yeah.
Don't think of it as carrying all the state. Think of it as carrying some minor encoded information. And that encoded information, absolutely, the semantics of it must be exchanged via your, what you call your orchestrator. I'd call the control plane. It doesn't matter. Top piece.
Well, I always separate it, right? Because, you know, with things like BGP, EVPN, you know, where's your control plane? It can be BGP, it can be Open Daylight, it can be whatever. And above that, there are automation tools that talk to Open Daylight. And above the automation tools, there's an orchestration engines that do the end-to-end, right?
Right. And let's say in this case, just to make life simple, we'll say the control plane has exchanged the semantics.
Yep.
So that exchange of semantics absolutely has to occur. But carrying complex state coupled to five tuple, which is what you'd have to do otherwise, has shown not to work. As you point out, we have no examples of that working. What having a small amount of in-band encoded data has done is it's very fast, very efficient, and it can come from other databases, orchestrators, or other systems and be reflected. So we don't have this overarching control plane that has to know all five tuples, all associated data, including transformations at all time. What we're able to say is, for a path, this is the information we found. And we've very much simplified that. One of the interesting things, and I don't know if you guys have seen it, there was a, I think it was a heavy reading report where they polled, you know, I forget how many operators and so on. And overwhelmingly, the in-band, quote unquote, what you would call in-band, seemed to be compelling. Now, I think there's a balancing act because, as you say, there's a control plane, there's signaling, but carrying a small amount of in-band encoded metadata seems to have struck the right balance. I'll give you an example.
Let me just ask an expanding question here, right? Are carriers doing that because that's all they can conceive of? Are they actually intelligent enough to understand the difference between in-band and out-of-band signaling and orchestration? Or are they just, like, I know most carriers that I've worked with in the last 15 years still use MPLS to be A and B end of a circuit.
So I would say that when I talk to customers about this, it's not just carriers. I'm actually, maybe I shouldn't confess, I'm because of where I report to, but I'm somewhat enterprise biased. And I find that increasingly the enterprise is looking to do this.
This is all enterprise, but that's not at scale. In the enterprise, if you could have 5,000 service functions in a data center, mm-hmm. that would be a huge data center. Right? And that's not scale. You can do that with OpenFlow today.
No. The metadata requirements in an enterprise, the complexity of the service chains is growing rapidly. I mean, things like branch and user and all this is being envisioned. I think the days, you know, of the enterprise being small scale is, you know, the big enterprises are large. I mean, they do a lot. The big major financial is as complicated, if not more so, than many service providers. But I think what we're finding is that the scheme is efficient, it works, and it provides, as I said, kind of that trade-off. Have a control plane, convey the meaning of the semantics, carry simple encoded metadata. And by the way, we have examples of doing it today, right? Forgetting NSH. I mean, the subscriber ID or tenant ID information is an example of the type of thing that gets carried today. All we say here is you might want more information. Now, the other thing to bear in mind is this information is overwhelmingly, because now, in a minute, you're going to tell me why I'm not right. So I'm going to preface it. I see where this is going, right? Yeah. Overwhelmingly meant for consumption by the services. It's not network information per se. And that is a little bit of a different model than what we're used to, right? So because what I use it for at the service is policy enforcement, not forwarding, not, you know, like DSCP, not queuing, none of those kind of things.
Yeah, see, I still think we're putting things into the network that don't need to be there. The functionality will be in the orchestrator or the automator, not in the actual network itself.
Right.
The idea of overblowing, you know, it's almost like, you know, people are doing what they know, not what they need to do. I only know how to use MPLS tags, so let's make a really, really big MPLS tag.
It's funny because the natural inclination for most people was to try to signal it out of band, and only as we work through it did this come to be. What I would say is NSH straddles a little bit. And what I mean by that is, I said, it gives you a simple encoded value to simplify your orchestration. So your orchestrator can say, look, when you see 62, you know it's Skype traffic. And when you see 65, you know it's, I don't know, whatever, the Netflix. Mm-hmm. And having that key, if you will, in the data plane vastly simplifies it because you don't have to do a cross correlation.
I see what you're saying.
If not, you're classifying. I mean, if not, you're doing relatively complex classifying per node.
Yeah, you don't want to be doing it per node. You just want to do it at the edge.
Hmm. Right, but I want to be able to carry it through because I'm going to need it time and time again in the chain. The other thing is I can carry information from disparate orchestration systems down the chain. So the example there is...
If I federated, you talk about a federated orchestration environment where one carrier could pass a given service to another carrier with an exchange data around the network services header.
That's one. I was thinking about a world, and again, I don't know why. I'm a sucker. I keep using the example I know the least about, but it's so compelling, is the mobility guys. No information about you and your phone from a system called PCRF. But the firewall doesn't speak PCRF. So they encode information, they deliver it to the firewall, and the firewall, again, I'm using firewall as an example, goes, oh, you're this kind of subscriber. I don't even know what that means. I don't speak this complicated mobile system. But when I see this, I got to do something. And it allows them to effectively convey complex out-of-band information in-band to a system that could never have consumed it.
But it's still got to be billed. So the out-of-band still has to exist.
But not for policy enforcement at the firewall, for example.
Yeah.
And I use firewall as an example.
I don't agree. Because you still have to bill it as it goes through the system. So somewhere that orchestration system will rewrite the network services header so it can charge back for it. Data doesn't ride free in a carrier network.
The charging could have occurred at ingress where they imposed it or at some other service node, but the firewall's not part of it.
Yeah, potentially.
I believe realistically in the models.
And they'll do they used to do in MPLS and just start tag popping. They'll start popping their own network services header on the front of another network services header. They won't exchange data.
Oh, between carriers? That's a different conversation. Yeah. I'm talking within a carrier. Yeah,
I understand. Yeah, no. But what you're talking about a use case, and I'm saying that, you know, what people will do is just keep injecting their own service headers at the edge, which is why the point of having the network service headers in the first place, right?
Yeah, you could certainly do, you know, like Q&Q, NSH and NSH, and because we carry a protocol type, that's a valid protocol stack.
It'd be stupid, but then carriers are pretty good at being stupid. Don't answer that. I mean, I can see all the logic and it all seems very natural. I still remain unconvinced that overall that this makes...
So Greg, here's a question I've been wanting to ask you because you've taken the contrarian view on NSH. If you don't do this sort of a solution and you want to achieve service chaining in the way that we've described, in your mind, what's the model?
So I would come back to the idea that an orchestrator can just define flow state. Now, not open flow. Open flow is not, you know, deep enough, but we now have devices that can do full packet inspection at line rate and just, you know, you create a state that says this is where it's got to go and an orchestrator lays those rules down in the devices. You don't have to have an SFF functionality with all this abstraction and indirection and complexity to be able to build a forwarding plane from service to service to service. I don't believe that this is necessary. I believe that I understand the logic that gets them here, but the complexity that's been designed into this whole layers of, you know, you're talking like 124 bits per packet being injected into the network services header. That's a significant impost in terms of if you're running an average size of 576 bytes, you're talking about a 3 or 4% increase in packet size. You're looking at all the complexity. If you read this, you're talking about frame formats. You now have an orchestrator that's going to work on network services header. The network services header have to be mapped to the underlying layer. This just seems way too complex. It's like cracking a nut.
It's funny because I would say having to track all flow state at all nodes, which is what you're suggesting. And I don't mean to sound I'm not trying to be contrary now. I'm just saying.
The idea is to get to the bottom of it, Maybe I'm not seeing the problem in the light. You know, you've got more information than me, perhaps.
So I'm saying, so we're only interested in NSH within the chain. So first and foremost. And I would posit that tracking all flow state, including transformations within a chain where you have to maybe scale up, scale down, account for loops and support loops. And what I mean by that is revisit the same service multiple times is far more complex if you're doing per flow packet forwarding.
Yeah.
than this. Now, you might say, look, man, I can do that today. You got these things that I don't have today. That's a valid point that, you know, we're obviously marching towards at a rapid rate. But, I mean, the example I give you is PBR. PBR doesn't work well for service chaining. People do it, but it's a per flow, per box game
of configuration. Yeah, but PBR doesn't scale because of the lack of the end-to-end visibility. It doesn't fundamentally not scale because it's PBR.
It doesn't scale for many reasons. One of them is that. But
And the second one is because our autonomous protocols don't understand PBR. But so self-describing, self-configuring protocols like OSPF, BGP, when you use PBR, you break the inherent nature of those control planes. The thing is, if you had a distributed, centralized control plane for PBR, it would work fine.
Maybe. Because when you go to the model of per SFF, I know they're not SFFs in your term, but per hop flow programming, you essentially devolve to PBR. So then you say, okay, I have I have a big orchestrator that can do this, but it has to know the state of all flows. Because don't forget, fundamentally in service chaining, and maybe we should have started with this, is we're altering the natural path of the packet. Maybe that's not always clear to people. And maybe we should all start with that. I have a packet going from source A to destination B. The whole point of service chaining is that I can't ensure that the services are going to be on the natural path. And more importantly, I don't want them necessarily to be there because I'm forcing them there.
No, you want to divert them to wherever they're being.
I want to divert them.
And the services might actually move. So
They might move, they might die, they might come up, they might scale, they might do all kinds of things.
You might have to wait for them to instantiate. So if you're saying, I might have a data center that's got 20 firewalls in it and all of a sudden I've got a traffic burst so I need to spawn another 10, it might take 2 seconds for those to spawn. So you need to hold it up and then divert into those systems as they grow, as they spawn.
And I guess what I would say is, you know, the per hop, because if you're going to do redirection, you know, a la flow state, per hop flow state, including load balancing, including transformations, is an incredibly complicated game. I would say ignoring installed base as the argument, because that's a different argument, you'd be far simpler, both in the data plane, but even more importantly, at your orchestrator, to use something like NSH. It know this. It vastly simplifies your orchestrator.
Yeah, but at the price of a vastly more complex network.
That's an interesting perspective. More complex, overhead, sure. We're adding a new header, that I accept.
You're now asking that's math, right? You've got to have SFFs in the path, so maybe the SFFs are in all of the virtual machines, but now you're asking firewall vendors or F5 load balancers, you know, the load balancing vendor to put an SFF function that now has to work with your orchestrator. Maybe somebody's going to say, I want my MPLS router to be acting as an SFF because I want to have compliance reasons where I need to do validation. So now all of a sudden my orchestration has got exponentially more complicated because now I actually have SFFs littered all over the countryside like, you know, glitter at a child's party.
No, but see, the distinction here, because it's a locator ID scheme, if you will, it's a separation, all that the orchestrator needs to know is where is the service and what SFF is it connected to? That's all it needs to know. And then the pathing is relative.
And there's so much imprecision there.
No, the opposite.
Yes, there is.
No, right? It's the opposite.
Because now you're relying on some thing that's not inside your control to have all the information it needs to make a correct decision. You're making the devices in the forwarding plane 10 times more complicated than they need to be.
I don't understand that. What imprecision am I looking at?
Okay, so if you fundamentally believe, what you're talking about is an implementation of promise theory, right? The idea is that instead of actually telling a device to do this, you're saying add a path that goes in this direction. And the device works out your intention, it promises to do it on your behalf, and then goes off and works out how to do it.
I think either I've grossly misstated my case or you're inferring something I didn't mean to state, and I'll accept either one of those.
Probably that's my fault, right? And I'm sort of thinking, but this is my problem is if you say, I'm just going to let the device handle it, I'm thinking big, expensive, complicated device, full of bugs, unreliable, crashes all the time, doesn't do the right thing, vendor, it doesn't read the standard right. Now I've got 10 years of people iterating forward until they all converge on a definition of OSPF, which is exactly what happened to us, right?
We're seeing...
It took 10 years for people to agree on a standardized implementation of MPLS, LDP, and BGP.
So I will tell you unequivocally, if you look at the open source work, you know, the open daylight, the OVS, yeah. all that stuff, we're finding the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. The definition of NSH is simple. You do a lookup in direction on a path ID. You pick your next one. There's no promise theory. It's very simple locator ID mapping. We know how to do that as an industry. Mm-hmm. There's the equivalent of a mapping server that pushes it. And there is no ambiguity, no promise theory. I just want to be clear because now we're going to confuse everyone even more. Most people are going to be Googling promise theory when they listen to this, right?
There's been plenty of.
There is no promise theory. There is none of that. It's simply abstraction and topology creation using that abstraction. Let's not make it more than that.
Okay. I think I get what you mean.
Yeah. There's nothing ambiguous or what's the right word? There's nothing
imprecise as well.
Imprecise about it. That's a great word. There's nothing imprecise. And if I implied otherwise, I apologize. We say there's a path ID. It's 10. For 10, do a lookup. Get your next hops that were given to you by a controller. Go to one or more next hops because, you know, ECMP, load balancing, et cetera. That's network stuff 101.
Yep.
Resolve.
Let the network do the ECMP because you don't know what the underlying network path looks like. And you don't want to know it because you don't want the complexity in your service path orchestration. Yeah.
Right, let that happen.
But doesn't your service path need to be network aware to be, or you're saying it doesn't?
Define network. Now I'm more careful now that we went down this promise theory. Define network aware.
Well, if I'm going to instantiate service functions, I have to know there's a sufficient bandwidth and latency guarantees between paths. I can't just keep popping and...
In general, my experience is people just pop and send. I don't know if you found that to be true. You could... make it quote-unquote network-aware and add more, you know, path computation and so on.
So this is where the orchestration comes in, right? So the orchestrator knows.
Can know. In my experience, in a data center, for example, that hasn't been an issue. Right? We have a lot of bandwidth. You know, absolutely you could, but in general...
So let me challenge you again, right? Yeah. Today we do, but when we get into micro-segmentation and you start spawning... dozens of firewalls or hundreds of firewalls for each micro segment that you want to deploy, bandwidth, east-west bandwidth is going to come under severe load.
Right. And then the question is that an NSH service chaining part or is it a scheduling part when they schedule the firewall?
It's critical to data center operations because as soon as you get away from the – so today what I can do is deploy a 10 gig to the leaf, ECMP, non-blocking. And there's plenty of bandwidth. But I'm pretty sure that within a few years, you're going to have a situation where the east-west conversation's going on between micro-segmentation because of mobility and nothing's locked within a rack. Your orchestrator needs to be aware of the bandwidth and needs to be provisioning the service templates in a way to make sure that you don't oversubscribe it.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I'm not debating, by the way. I want to be clear. I'm simply saying, has that become a function of intelligent scheduling from a placement or does it become a function of you know,
The orchestrator needs to know all of the networking information and now starts to need to map the network architecture onto the network services header. But the network services header is meant to be abstracted away from the network. And then, so why am I using network services header?
Honestly, I'm going to argue that case is the exact reason you use network service header. Because of the abstraction, we're completely decoupled. So you could say, look, for path, again, I always use 10. I don't know why. It's a number I can count to with two hands. I'm going to take path 10. And for path 10 at today, the controller or the controller returns the following next hop. Mm. Network conditions have changed. I'm going to return a different next hop. But hey, I didn't go and change my service topology or my NSH.
Right.
And that's very, very powerful. That's the key, is that we're not overburdening NSH by being a network protocol. And conversely, you're not trying to cram this alternate topology, which is the service chain, into the existing. And that's what I'm saying. Using flow programming, that's a lot harder. Now we can decouple the two and you can have each evolve independently.
Yeah, but flow programming will have much greater insight into the network itself.
But you can achieve, maybe.
You could achieve it with network service header, but only if you start mapping network state to the service state and then bonding the two together in the orchestrator and then you've got complexity.
But it's the same complexity you'd have otherwise. And here, what you can do is not.
But now I'm mapping two autonomous. I'm mapping two different systems to try and bring one. I might as well just have one to start with.
Oh, see, I would argue that you're overburdening one with complexity you don't want.
Yeah, which is the service topology. That's a fair counter argument. Yeah. That is a fair counter argument.
Yeah, and I think it's a philosophical one to some extent.
Well, the point is to try. And again, so I am taking an opposing view because there are philosophical points. You can say, why not do everything in one system? And you know, there will be companies who go down this path, right? So at this point, Cisco's championing network service has added, so no doubt it's going to develop software that uses this architecture. But I'm pretty sure there are going to be other companies out there who are going to say, we can do this all with flow state. And I'm inclined to believe that software is far more capable than it ever has been in the last 20 years, and that we can solve problems in software that weren't historically soluble, even at scale.
Let me make one little kind of point there is, you know, Cisco is certainly championing NSH, but it's not a Cisco protocol.
And yes, sorry.
I just want to be clear here because...
Yeah, that's, you know, why I said Cisco's championing NSH, not...
But as is Intel, as is F5, as is et cetera, right? I mean, we're a broad coalition championing it, and we do multi-vendor demonstrations and multi-vendor,
let me be a little cynical. These companies always come around the Cisco Jam 10. They're like flies around a Jam 10. Right. Whenever you guys do standards, it's the same list of people always lining up to sign up on the RFCs.
Again, I don't want to sound defensive or not. I'm just trying to – if you look at, you know, the Alcatel-Lucents and so on, I certainly wouldn't call them part of our jam tent, right? So,
P. Garg from Microsoft is always on the thing. Chris Wright from Red Hat was also on the VXLAN thing. You know, Tom Nadeau from Brocade, same names all the time.
It's the industry, small industry.
Sure, but, you know,
I'm just saying, you know, when NTT releases a press release talking about six vendors performing, you know, service chaining interoperability tests in NTT labs, that's not a Cisco thing. That's all I just want to point out.
Yeah, no, I understand. I'm just saying, you know, so far Cisco has been outspoken about network services header, and that's, I don't know, maybe that's just me. What about you, Ethan?
No, they definitely have been outspoken about it. You know, Cisco's been right in the forefront of it, and it's mostly you guys' names that are tied to it, at least visibly, that I'm seeing and are making the most noise. Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're trying to take away from the fact that there's other people involved, because I did the same thing that you did, Greg. I can tell by the names that you raised. Chris Wright, Tom Nadeau, they're all on the IETF draft spec as well, as contributors. Listed at the bottom there, along with lots of other people in the industry. So it is broader than just Cisco, of course.
Right. I mean, you know, Wim from Alcatel, and, you know, Joel Halpern from Ericsson. You know, there's a lot of.
And I mean, I guess the other flip side of this for me is that I've been looking at things like this idea of tag networking for over 15 years and seen several different initiatives in this space, you know, crawl out of the primordial slime of somebody's thing and fail to grow lungs and just die miserably. I'm deeply cynical about, you know, these things actually surviving. And network policy has been, I've been through 4-5 different time-wasting exercises on this stuff and seen nothing. And literally it's been a time waste. I've wasted, you know, hundreds of hours reading up on various technologies to see nothing happen. So I'm cynical.
Fair. Cynicism is always good to have, right? I mean, there's no problem there. I would say there's one distinction, and I'll give you one more comment. But the distinction is, in this context, the tag, quote-unquote tag, is not a transport header, right? Yeah. And that changes things quite a bit.
It's not a transport tag. It's not a routing tag.
Right.
It's not a cross tag. It's a huge difference. This is a service tag. And the idea is to say, you know, it's meant to be like, this flow needs to pass through this network application.
This flow and this associated information about it needs to pass through.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I've said before, I'm not sure that we need a custom header in the frame to do this. It's not, I think there'll be more than one solution in this space. Yeah.
No, that's true, I think, in modern networking in general. Now, the one thing I'll tell you is I've been crawling around in the sludge for a long time around services and service headers and chaining and, you know, the kind of I have legs.
Just to interrupt you there, I'm very proud of that metaphor. It's
I know. That's why I was very impressed when I used it. I've shed the tail. My tail fell off. So, figure we can keep going with that. And I will say, I think there's a certain amount of acceptance now in the industry that this concept of – let's leave pathing. We've beaten pathing to death. There's a certain amount of acceptance that this – some form of bounded in-band metadata for policy seems to be, you know, really taking off and doing well. And I think it's just, we've matured in the services plane. I think that's what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I can see all sorts of uses for this, especially in mobility, carrier mobility for 3G, you know, when as a handset roams between 3G, 4G, LTE, you know, and having been one of those people who was a victim of IP mobile back in the day. Jesus, that should never have crawled out of the slime. But, you know.
You know, it was on my CCIE research recently, IPv6 mobility.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. RFC 1925. Every dumb idea will come around again, you know, no matter how badly it worked last time. That's absolutely true. Rule 11, I think that is, if I remember right. You know, I just not sure that, and it, like this, it all comes down to this signaling. The things that I've seen be successful consistently are the things that are direct, precise, accurately defined, and you know exactly where you stand. And the challenge that we have in networking is that quite often we just hand it off to these protocols that are autonomous, self-configuring, and they have to. And that means that those protocols have to be truly robust, but they're not. They're eventually consistent. They're slow to pass data. They're not cluster capable. They're not, you know, whatever. And when we get into these sorts of ideas about, you know, let's pass some metadata around, everybody's got to agree on the metadata to be useful. And that means that every system in the path has to be able to comprehend the metadata. And that's a very big ask. I'll keep an eye on the slime and hope that whatever crawls out actually has lungs.
Yeah.
Those are areas we're working through. I mean, I hear the comment, but, you know, Paul and I's stance has been, you know, if you want to move an industry, you have to do something and not just sit there and just let it ride, right? So, you know, we're making a lot of effort within the open source community, within the standardization and so forth. And, you know, it's funny, I was sat here listening to the comments about earlier, and I was just thinking back to the days when we started doing the MPLS VPN, and, you know, I was heavily involved in that, and I heard the same comments. Oh, this thing's going nowhere. It's, you know, how are you going to migrate this customer onto this type of thing? And, you know, look where we are today. So, I see the same thing going on here, and you know, and I personally believe in what we're doing, and you know, and I think there's a way to go, and there's lots of things that we need to resolve through the partnerships that we have, but I think it's the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't get to talk about service graphs versus service change, which is
I don't think there's enough time in this in your podcast.
Yeah, don't start Paul on service.
Yeah, don't start
graphs,
me
please.
On that. Yeah.
Believe me, we've had that discussion many times, and I know all the arguments on that one. I don't want to hear it again.
Yeah, if you think this was nerdy, wait till you start that one. You guys are going to hang up on me. But I would say one of the things I would suggest, you know, and certainly good debate, good skepticism is always welcome. By the way, I want to be clear, we value questions, concerns, feedback, pushback. Play with some of the open source, play with some of the OVS stuff, some of the open daylight. I think it gives you a good kind of feel for how things move around.
And I think that's probably a good point to start wrapping this one up. So what I would like to do is just say thanks so much to our Jim and Paul for joining us today. Jim, why don't you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
Mainly I'm not a big social networking fan, and mainly because my wife spends so much time on Facebook, so I'm kind of it kind of puts me off. So best contact is through email, jgeeshar@cisco.com.
Fantastic. And Paul?
I'm a Luddite, and the easiest way to contact me, and I encourage you if you have questions to please do so, is paulq@cisco.com, and or at stop by and say hi at an IETF meeting anytime, or the Open Daylight IRC channel, or any of those open source development forums.
Yeah, I don't think I'll ever get to an IETF, sadly. I don't have a nerd daddy that can afford to send me. It's one of life's little mysteries. What I've done here is I've taken as many of the links to the things that we talked about in the show today so that you can find them. Particularly, I've put linked to the draft for network services header, and I've caught the NTT presentation that you said, which is the IETF 92 presentation, and I'll put a link to their slides, which talks about how they did this testing. Paul or Jim, is there anything else that I should link to? Is there something on SFFs or, you know, the working group perhaps?
Yeah, I would
link directly to the working group because there's a lot of documents in there related to this. And, you know, the architecture itself that we built within the working group, that's actually in the ISG for publication at the moment. So I would certainly encourage people to read that because it'll tie in with the encapsulation and some of the other things going on. And I think, you know, we didn't get a chance to really delve into a lot of use cases here, but there are a couple of documents there that look at the specifically the mobility and the data center use cases, and I think those are worth a read.
Okay, so I'll drop a link here. I've just found it to the service function chaining working group, and you can find that in the show notes on Packet Pushers. And that's it for the show today. Thanks to Mr. Banks for coming today.
At EC Banks on Twitter, ethancbanks.com is my blog. And this was a lot of fun. It was really awesome to read the draft and kind of get it in my head what was going on and then talk to one of the guys that helped write it. So, yeah, that was always a good opportunity.
Yeah, it was very – it's educational, by the way, the whole process of learning a new protocol. Mm-hmm. Although I'm getting a little tired of learning new protocols. That I don't anyway, so my name is Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com, and you can follow me on the Twitter as @etherealmind. You can find me on a whole bunch of the other social media channels, except I don't really care about them because they're boring. This has been a Packet Pushers Priority Queue. Thanks so much for listening to the show. If you would like to find out more, don't hesitate to go over to iTunes. And if you've enjoyed the show, it would be really, really great if you could head over and leave a review saying how fantastically awesome you found it, because it helps us find more listeners. And that really helps us to grow the show. We have a website. You can go and check it out. And if you would like to write something about a blog something, maybe everybody's got one blog post in them, and the Packet Pushers website might be a place for you to come and share that wisdom. Don't forget to follow Packet Pushers on the Twitter as @PacketPushers, but always remember that too much networking would never be enough.